Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are many podcasts competing for your time and attention. We hope to bring you the content and guests to be your go-to podcast for the study of war, warfare, and strategy. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you find this episode both entertaining and informative. Okay, welcome back to Revolution in Military Affairs. Today we are going back to the future, if that's the appropriate way to say this. We have brought back Andrew Carr for another conversation, although on a different topic today, but no less fascinating as our previous conversation. Previously, we talked to Andrew about time and the art of war, time and war and warfare. And this time we're going to talk about strategy based off a new paper. And just to refresh everybody's memory, Andrew is a senior lecturer at the Australian National University. And so, Andrew, thank you again for working with me on the weird, 17-hour time difference that we have to navigate here. I have a hard time just making the one-hour time difference with East Coast and Central time zone in the U.S. work. So thank you for squaring me away on the time and meeting me today. So thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure.
First off, I wanted to, congratulate you on two things. First, on the new publication, which we're going to talk about today. So for those who are not aware, the new paper that Andrew has out is called Strategy as Problem Solving, and it was published in the most recent edition of Parameters. So volume 54, edition or number one, so the spring 2024 edition of Parameters, which just came out. Which this episode, I think, will come out in mid-May. So just came out is like early April, if you're keeping score on what time this actually is. So so the latest edition of Parameters, but also this article was mentioned in a article that just came out in Military Review on the on the April 2024 online exclusive article published today or yesterday, which would be April 9th or 10th. Today's actually April 10th, so I think the article was published yesterday, but written by Lieutenant General Beagle and Lieutenant Colonel Tom Gaines out of Fort Leavenworth. The article's entitled Creating Strategic Problem Solvers. And so Andrew's within the first sentence, actually, is mentioned by name. His article's mentioned by title, not by title, but by subject. And Andrew's mentioned by name in the first line of that article by General Beagle. So kudos to you on both those fronts, Andrew. That's pretty exciting.
Thank you very much. And look, I wrote it for this paper for a professional military audience. You know, I think it's a more practical and useful approach, kind of certainly flowing from my time teaching at the Australian War College. So I'm really actually very excited to see it kind of getting some traction in this audience. And, you know, that's where I think the really important strategic debates and theories are, less so in some of the academic forums. So, you know, this is the group I like to talk to and to learn from a lot of ways as well.
This is extremely valuable, and so we're going to dive deep into this. And so with that, I think, you know, we've had several conversations on this podcast leading up to right now between you and I. And when I say we, I mean multiple guests and I have so far up to this point on strategy, because I think it's something very much to the point of your paper that is that needs re-examining, right? It needs examination. It needs reframing. It needs to be looked at again and said, hey, are we looking at this thing correctly? And so I think to start this conversation, I want to ask you a couple very basic questions before we dig into the kind of the meat and potatoes. I think generally speaking then, what is and what is not strategy?
So my views have evolved quite a bit on this question. You know, I was very taken by Hugh Strawn's idea that's really tied to that use of military force. And I think there's really something to that. I try to keep our conversations in that area a lot of the times. But I've slowly come to the idea, kind of through reading a bit of complexity science, that actually it's about dealing with a certain kind of problem. And I think the complexity science literature is really good because it says different environments act in different ways, and we should approach them in different ways. And some environments, you know, if you're a mechanic dealing with a car or a baker kind of making a cake, like it's repeatable and reliable solutions, and you don't need strategy to solve the problems of that kind of an environment. There are other more complicated environments, you know, a lot of day-to-day human life. And, you know, we don't need strategy to kind of get our kids to school or do most of our day-to-day work and handle those issues. But there are certain kinds of problems in the world. You know, if we're dealing with peer competitor states, if we're dealing with climate change, if we're dealing with, you know, even just, you know, how does a military use force to change the political views of an adversary? That is, you know, a genuinely complex system. And I think that's where strategy starts to come in. And what struck me as I read the kind of complexity science discussions of these environments is that a lot of really classic strategic theorists, you know, particularly Clausewitz, they talk about it in very similar ways. You know, it's not linear, that there are these, you know, phenomena that kind of bubble up. You have to really spend a lot of time just analyzing what kind of environment you're in. And so I've come to this view that strategy is about solving a very specific kind of problem, those that we find in those complex systems.
For a lot of folks that do read Clausewitz, not to nerd out on Clausewitz, because I'm not going to nerd out on Clausewitz, but one thing he does say, to your point, is that, and I'm loosely paraphrasing it here, is that, you know, essentially, things aren't in war, things are not often repeatable. And so the same solution cannot often be applied and the same outcome be generated. And so you do have to be pragmatic when you approach solving military problems. And I think that idea there, that idea that solving military problems pragmatically is the essence of strategy in many cases. So I guess you may have indirectly answered it through that process of dialogue there, but what do you think, big broad brushstroke, is not strategy?
So I think there's a lot of areas that we've kind of tied into strategy because everyone wants to be a strategist, and it's kind of often a very nice label to apply. Yeah. And
it makes people feel cool saying they're strategic, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
you got to put it on your LinkedIn profile, strategic thinker, right? Strategist.
Exactly. Yeah. And also the ambition of strategists has grown, right? You know, and part of why I wrote this paper is that I got really dissatisfied with our kind of strategic debates being all about creating these vast documents, you know, 150, 200 pages that talk endlessly about how difficult the world is, how it's changing and evolving. And then at the very end, you get this little bit that says, you know, we should spend $50 billion on this particular military capability. We should spend $20 billion on upgrading our diplomats or whatever. And, you know, there just didn't seem much connection between that, but also the amount of issues that strategists were expected to handle and be responsible for. you know, not only in the military sphere, but political, economic, social, technology, endless amounts. And I think it's just too much.
Yeah.
And so what I wanted to do with this paper is to say, well, you know, what's really essential that strategists do that is different from, you know, what leaders do, which is different from what officials do. And I think that's the strategist's job, is to diagnose the problems. You know, what exactly should we be focusing on, and why is it so difficult? You know, how do we actually understand its dynamics? And if you have a good diagnosis, I think that enables then the leader to be able to say, you know, leader or decision maker, you know, yes, I agree, here's the resources we can use, or we can approach this problem, but it has to be through these kind of principles, these values for our organization, or, you know, the timing isn't right, let's work on some other issues. But also recognizing the crucially important role of officials, you know, diplomats, you know, people in the military, kind of down to very tactical levels, right? Their insights, their ability to actually implement policy, but also to feed information back into the system and say, look, this is working, it's not working, have you tried this idea, what about this opportunity? Like, that is really crucial. And I think our you know, validization of strategists has kind of excluded a lot of their insights and opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of carve out a bit of space for the role of, you know, officials who implement it to be actually a really crucial part of how organizations solve problems through feedback, through helping to kind of refresh that role, and not just making it all about this kind of strategist playing 4D chess with nations.
Planners, where do planners fit within the role of strategists? Are strategists also planners, or planners uniquely something separate? Can they be, should they be thought of, say, the, you know, in the same realm? Where do they fall within that?
There's this really nice quote in Everett Carl Dolman's book, Pure Strategy, where it says, you know, every kind of strategy needs a plan, but the plan is not strategy. And I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, planning and setting goals are really important part of doing this work, but they are proxies. They are kind of temporary stages for how we actually proceed. And I think we've made too much about trying to kind of nail it down and having something that looks really good on paper.
Yeah.
And not seeing these as just iterative steps that emerge from the work, but also kind of just enable us to take that next step. We've tried to kind of hold them up too much as these kind of artifacts or these symbols of good strategy, when in fact they're just kind of working documents and kind of useful practices to help us on that next step. And so, you know, I have a real problem with the focus on goals that we often have at the moment. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our planning can also be a way of just trying to lock things in place that often has more to do with kind of bureaucratic roles and positions, being the person who develops the plan, or kind of trying to keep the organization on a preferred pathway, rather than kind of seeing the value of, you know, allowing these things to adapt and evolve, and recognizing that in a lot of cases we have to adapt and evolve. Perhaps not as far as, say, some of that emergent strategy literature talks about, but yeah. I think some of the kind of more deliberative grand strategy has pushed our focus too far in terms of trying to lock everything in place, given, you know, if we take our rhetoric seriously, just how complicated and complex our world today is.
An interesting point, well, real quick on Dolman. So Pure Strategy by Dolman, I don't remember if I mentioned this last time we talked. I know I mentioned it at some point on this podcast. But that book is like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, whichever the original is. It's like the boat ride scene, I think, when you read that book. It's like taking your mind and turning it inside out and taking everything you've ever thought and then questioning your belief system as it relates to military strategy and strategy as a whole, right? And like policy. It's phenomenal. So anybody out there, you got to go get Dolman's book. It's actually kind of hard to find. I have a copy on my bookshelf because I went and bought it. We had to read it when I was in Sam's. And when I first read it, I was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever read. Because it was one of those books where I read it and I was like, meh, you know, it made me like, ugh, cringe. And then I was like, as I was like reflecting and I was flipping through my notes and looking back at my notes, I was like, this guy may be onto something. And then I went back yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. I think it's the best book written on strategy in the 21st century, full stop.
Yep.
And it really influenced and shaped a lot of my thinking. And you know, my current views have evolved a little bit kind of beyond that. But really, you know, a lot of the threads that I now think, oh, look, I've got a new idea.
Yeah.
I go back to his work and I'm like, oh, actually, you know, he identified some of this stuff quite early on. So it's a must read.
And that's everyone. So I took it with me, well, when I deployed to Iraq in 2017, and I read it another time while I was there. And so I've read the book probably 5 times total. And I read it again when I was in Iraq in 2017. And then I loaned it off to actually a couple of Aussie officers that were working with me in the J5. And they read it and they're like, I was going to say dude, but I guess you guys don't say dude. They said mate, you know? And they both loved it. And anyway, it was, you know, it's phenomenal. And it's one of those things. It's a pivot point book, you know, it like reshapes your mind. And from there, like you diverge. And it was one of the things that really got me going on, because a lot of my thinking is systems oriented thinking too, you know? And so, I think like, Danella Meadows and her book Systems Thinking is like foundational to a lot of where I view, how things operate. And I think things are systems, open systems, you know, dynamic systems. And a lot of that is also divergent from what Dolman talks about in his book. He doesn't reference her necessarily, but the idea of systems thinking in his book, he talks about systems, and I'm like, well, what is this? Let me go find more about systems thinking, you know. And her book was one of the books that I came away from based off that. And his, so that's how his book is. It like when you look at it and you're like, let me go look at this, you know. And so like for me too, it was one of those things where I'm like, after I reread it a couple times, I was like, holy cow, this is amazing. And it's one of those things, you don't even have to like buy it, not even buy in. You don't have to agree with everything he says to still think it's amazing. It's just amazing in that it's so eye-opening in many regards. Anyway, that's a total inadvertent like 10-minute plug for Dolman's book. It's
happy
really hard.
Yours. Happy doing
it. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of hard to find, actually, but if you can find it, and you're willing to spend the money, because I think when I bought it, it was like $70, but totally, totally worth the money. And I've read it enough to, I keep looking over at my bookshelf at it, with a little twinkle in my eye. But anyway, what the hell were we talking about? I don't even remember at this point. Planning, strategy, goals, something. I think that's the end of the episode. Are we done? let's get back on task here. Oh, yeah, that's what we were talking about. Okay, bureaucratic process. That was what I was going to say next. So when we talk about strategists, and I'm going to ask you about what makes a good or bad strategist after this, but when we think about a strategist, is that something that's innate in a person that may or may not be something that is unlocked? Is it something that you can point at somebody and say that individual is a good strategist and they may or may not know it? Is it something you can volunteer and say, I'm a good strategist? Or, you know, is it something that like, I know like in the US military, I don't know about other militaries. It's like an opt-in thing. You can say, I want to go be a strategist. And then we can say, oh yes. Okay, sure. Come be a strategist. And there's zero, like strategic thinking test that you have to do, right, to get into that. So curious on your thoughts about that. And then the follow-up to that is good, bad strategist. What are your thoughts on what makes that? And then after that, we'll run down the rabbit hole on your paper.
Yeah, look, it's a fascinating question and perhaps one I'm not really well placed to answer because I haven't worked professionally as a strategist. You know, I don't call myself a strategist. I'm an academic, I'm a geek who like finds this stuff interesting. But you know, I spent a lot of time teaching at the War College here in Australia and talking to people in defense and, you know, people who do actually create these strategic documents. And I think for me, anyone can be a strategist. And I think it's a certain mindset that is, you know, comfortable with complexity. And I don't mean that in the kind of scientific sense, but just comfortable with the fact that, you know, things are not linear and clear and straightforward and that there is an absolute right answer to situations and, you know, understanding that the world is contradictory, right? Yeah. Dolman's work is fascinating because he tries to connect science and strategy in a way that I often find kind of quite antithetical to how I approach it, because that, you know, kind of historic traditional approach of science that we look for these universal laws that should apply, that's the goal for knowledge. I think for strategy, it's the complete reverse in a lot of ways, that, you know, chasing such goals will lead you to very poor decision making. And so I think it is a certain mindset that is good at that. The more that I've gotten into this idea of problem solving, I do think some people are better at that innate, you know, how could we approach this issue from different ways? And it might actually be that those who've had, you know, much more varied careers, those who have, you know, what we might call street smarts, could probably actually be far better at doing these kinds of tasks than, you know, those who've just read 1,000 books, for, you know, having that kind of willingness to go for it. So I'd say that that desire to try and be effective, to try and solve problems, to kind of muck in, I think is really essential. That comfort with realizing that the world is contradictory and being okay with that and kind of making progress. And that willingness that to hear different views and not be kind of challenged by it as well. You know, I regularly kind of change my mind on things and I'm okay saying, look, I was wrong about that stuff. And, you know, I think you have to be to make it work within larger organizations, but also just so that you can kind of hold on and kind of adapt within these kind of confusing environments. And, you know, that's very different to what we often want from, say, leaders, right? Like we have this kind of traditional view that the leader is this Winston Churchill, you know, we'll fight on the beaches, we'll fight till the end of time kind of, you know, stand of principle. And that's not the, what I think strategists do. The strategist should be the person who actually says, well, it's changed, it's evolved, it's adapted. Like, let's shift and adjust with that. And, you know, leaders might decide, look, we're not going to do that because of other reasons. And I think that's a legitimate disagreement. So, you know, strategists should be a small group. They shouldn't always be driving and controlling decisions, but hopefully they're the people who are able to say, you know, this is what we should be thinking about, and this is why it's so complex and difficult, but here perhaps are better ways of making our way through it.
Yeah, I like the idea that comfortable with complexity in my mind is often comfortable with ambiguity, right? You know, like I think those two things are often interchangeable. Complexity just means that things are ambiguous and they're going to be, you're going to be challenging to be able to put your thumb on a right answer. And I think the science part is also useful because, you know, it's one of those situations where you have to understand how things work to also understand that, like, they're, again, not, you're not going to be able to put your thumb on how things are at the end, but you should know where they should be at the end, but that they're not going to be there, so that then you understand that whatever the system is, again, using air quotes here for people who can't see me doing air quotes, that it's not working the way it should be. So then you understand what you need to do to try and make it work the way it should be, whatever that system is, you know? And I think that that's one of those ways in which understanding science, whatever that science may be as it pertains to the thing you're trying to fix. And I know I'm using very, very ambiguous, loose language right there, but we're talking in theoreticals right now anyway. But I think that that's where that idea of science really does help. And, like, again, going back to Dolman, it's very useful. I'm curious too, like, as you've done this research, and this is more just me asking you a question for my own general knowledge, because I'd be interested to see this if you have seen it. If, like, doing your research on all this, have you come across any empirical studies on like any grading on military or professional, or not professional, political strategists, like any rubric type thing? Like, if we were to go grade good and bad strategists, and here's like a scorecard, have you seen anything like that?
No, not that I've seen. And I mean, I tend to think that strategy is very much circumstantial. Like I don't think that, you know, the classic works of strategic theory are, you know, works for all time. I mean, Thucydides says that, but, you know, he's very much a general trying to understand the Athenian laws, and he's trying to then kind of grapple with, well, what's the implications of that for, you know, dealing with these kinds of issues. And you can go through all of the classic kind of strategic thinkers and realize that, you know, what seem their broad overarching principles are really them trying to grapple with the very specific situations that they're in. And that doesn't reduce the value of it, but I think it does open us up to realize that, you know, the types of strategists should be reflecting the types of environment that we kind of find ourselves in. And So I think the kind of strategy that was very popular in the post-Cold War era is not the kind of strategy that we should be using today. And, you know, in the post-Cold War era, there was this great focus on goals, and there was this assumption in a lot of ways of order that, you know, this was the unipolar moment. The US was the unquestioned superpower. And we were hopeful that international institutions and the US would kind of enable a more structured world. And so then the big debates became about, well, you know, particularly US strategists, how do we apply resources, because we've got so many of them, to these problems? And do we have the will to actually stick with these issues and kind of see it through? And, you know, that all made sense for a lot of those kinds of situations. But when you're looking at a problem like, say, China today, like, it's not just about applying resources or being efficient in our means in that way, or even just this question of willpower. You know, are we determined to kind of stand up to this authoritarian threat? More fundamental, I think we have to say, well, what actually is the China problem for the US, for the West? You know, and how do we want to actually try and deal with that and to relate our interests and our available resources and realize that both of them are actually quite flexible. So I see each strategist as very much just a product of their time. And so their value is really, you know, how good are they at addressing the problems of their time? And maybe that's through offering ideas that help to sharpen other people's thinking rather than being necessarily what ends up as policy. But hopefully they can also give ways for policymakers to be able to say, here's a better way of thinking about it or trying to approach and understand what's going on. And to me, that's really where the most valuable kind of strategic contribution can be.
Yeah, I'm going to be somewhat antagonistic, not with you, but with the general audience, because it's my podcast and I can. I completely agree with what you said about strategists being a product of their time and people writing at the time being a product of their time. And so this is one of the beefs I have with everybody standing up on their copy of On War and beating their chest about how Clausewitz is, you know, this thing that stands the test of time and will never, ever, ever not be applicable. And I think, like you said, strategists are a product of their time, right? He's writing about the Napoleonic Wars. He's writing about, you know, Frederick the Great. And some of that stuff transcends time to a degree. I think a lot of it is transcendent, yes, but a lot of it is also, you can throw it away. Like 75% of that book doesn't apply beyond today. And then there's a good portion that does. And then, you know, it's funny too, because like I'm being over general. There are a lot of people that are like, hey, this thing's terrific, but then they want to trash Jomini, you know, and they're both writing about the exact same thing at the exact same time, right? But then, like, Western military doctrine's still, like, 95% Jominian. So it's just the irony and all that.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Yeah. I just think that that's I like that you said that, because it's not lost on me that we're very the royal we here, very hypocritical. With that said, I appreciate everybody with suffering through my antagonistic moment there with me. Let's jump into your paper, because that was a good segue. I may have lost the segue point because there really was a good tie-in. I think I just blew it with that. with my little monologue there. But so your paper is really about problem solving and relating strategy to problem solving, and really, I think, getting away from what strategy today in Western military thinking has been reduced down to, I think is a good way to probably frame it, which is essentially the application of resources in a resource-constrained environment. And balancing risk, you know, and again, that simple heuristic of ends, ways, means, right? and you're pushing it more towards the idea of thinking about problem solving and applying. And I know I'm going to butcher this because it's an Irish word, a traditional Irish word, but it's Canavan. Say it again.
I think it's Welsh, actually.
Welsh, is that what it is? Canavan.
Welsh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I knew. See, I butchered it. Try not to butcher it. So, anyway, with that, I think I'll turn it over to you and let you cut. Oh, also, real quick, before I turn it over to you, you highlighted Bernard Brody's paper, Science or Strategies of Science, in your paper, and it refreshed my memory. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back and read that paper. And I went back and read that paper. And that paper's terrific, by the way. So I just wanted to thank you for highlighting that paper in your paper, because I hadn't read that in a long time. So anyway, with that, please go ahead and give us a rundown on the highlights.
As I said earlier, like Dolman's work was quite influential for mine. And I was also being very influenced by Jeffrey Mizer's work. And I know you chatted to him recently. And I think his stuff on theory of victory is excellent. And, you know, Frank Hoffman's written about it, and a number of other people have picked it up. And, you know, getting those causal links and thinking about how do actions actually lead to where we want to go, I think that's really essential. And I've got a lot of respect for it. But I think there's a step before that. And that step is kind of saying, well, what exactly is the issue? Like, why is this so difficult? And what are the kind of dynamics that are at work at it? And how should we be trying to approach these challenges before it? That, you know, I often think it's about theories of victory. It's these multiple ones and kind of evolving as we go. And so I see my work as kind of very connected to that and kind of sitting very kind of comfortably alongside or together with that work. And what I'm really arguing here is that there's different kinds of environments that we face in the world. And so I draw on a little bit of complexity science, the Kudumvan framework of Dave Snowden, to say, you know, different environments lead you to solve problems in different ways. And the strategist's task is, when you have these complex problems, to diagnose them, which is first about identifying, you know, what problems are most important, what problems perhaps should be focused on first because they might enable cumulative benefits in solving other problems. And then really trying to interrogate them and saying, you know, what are the dynamics going on? And so complexity science gives us some kind of useful tools for that. But a lot of strategic theory is also in many ways about this diagnosis. And it's actually a term that I picked up from Andrew Marshall and George Kennan, you know, these Cold War theorists who saw their job, you know, not as creating these great mission statements or long-term goals for their society, but practically working through the direct challenges that they were facing and saying, well, how do we better understand what's going on? So in Kennan's Long Telegram, you know, he describes his role as akin to kind of a doctor studying an unruly patient. And that was obviously the Soviet Union. And so he tries to say, well, why is the Soviet problem so difficult? What kind of an adversary are they? And that then leads to policy responses, which come, you know, to be the strategy of containment that follows through. And so this view of strategists is, you know, trying to identify what problems really matter for your society right now that are impeding well-being, trying to diagnose why they're so difficult, and then pass that up the chain, pass that to others to be able to understand it. And that's a much smaller view in many ways of what the strategist does, as opposed to that kind of overarching world kind of knitted together that kind of provides, you know, these singular grand visions that lead us for the next 50 years. But hopefully it's actually more useful in trying to meaningfully address kind of what we're facing today and kind of trying to realize the ways that we can kind of use some of these insights from complexity science, some of these Cold War theorists, but there's actually a nice connection between them in terms of that down to, you know, practical focus on what's actually matters for us today and how do we make some progress on it.
Based off what you identified or came across when you were working on this paper, how does the strategic threat environment shape the heuristic used during the time in which that environment exists to articulate strategy? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so in the Kunovan framework, and I've mentioned a little bit of this before, but they say there's, you know, four different kinds of environments that we might face.
Yeah.
So there's clear systems, which, mm-hmm. you know, you, the mechanic or the chef kind of in their environments or in a lab, and you get kind of the problems have repeatable solutions and yeah. consistent approaches that we can use. There's chaotic environments where, you know, you don't really need or use strategy. Like in a natural disaster, you don't sit down and think, what's our strategy? Hopefully yeah. you're already able to apply, you know, some basic ideas about what we should be doing first and how to do it. And you're much more about responding to the immediate situation. And hopefully over time, those systems tend to stabilize a little bit. And then you can start to think strategically in terms of longer term and some of these bigger picture stuff. There's also complicated environments. And in the paper, I draw a very loose analogy. And it's deliberately trying to be a quite loose one, that if clear systems are a little bit akin to tactics, that you can have, you know, best practice, you can have doctrine that is actually very effective and meaningful, despite how varied tactical environments can be, that it can be applied very usefully. The complicated system is a bit like the operational level in that there are, you know, unique problems, but experts make a really important contribution. There are tied and trusted techniques that can be adapted in unique, in different ways, and then applied to the operational art that is kind of pursued and applied in that situation. And so then finally, there is genuinely complex systems, and they have their own unique dynamics in that clear and complicated environments are pretty consistent in terms of how they operate. But in a complex system, the amount of order changes over time. They're not linear. So you can put lots of resources in and nothing much changes. But then suddenly this small little effect has a vast, you know, change in terms of the end result of it. So it's not proportional. There's, you know, really important roles for feedback and for adaption. And particularly that you have these, you know, other actors who are feeding back and adapting as well within the environment. And then finally, that you get these emergent phenomena. And so what we're looking for in complex systems is really just kind of pockets of order. How do we create a situation that for a temporary period is advantageous to us? Because it's never going to be more than temporary, but that's actually a good outcome when we can do that. And so, you know, George Kenan doesn't use any of this language in his long telegram, but he says, look, now, what we should be doing is how do we exploit the kind of value of us being the stronger side, the Soviets being weaker, them having their own unique dynamics because of their history and their philosophy and their culture and everything else going on, and use that to our advantage to kind of wait out some of their more difficult periods and to shift the nature of our relationship so that it's, you know, less antagonistic, or there are opportunities for us to kind of prevent the Soviets from achieving some of their goals. And that should be the limit of our objective. And I think that more humble vision of strategy actually kind of, I think, really makes sense in the kind of world that we're entering now today.
So when we think about strategy as problem solving, what are some unique ways that we can go about teaching this methodology and this way of thinking that differ perhaps from ways that we've traditionally been teaching strategy over the past 20 or 30 years?
Part of why I really like the idea of strategy as problem solving is that there's already a lot of research on what is problem solving, how do we go about solving problems. And so that means there are tools that are already available for practitioners and tools for teachers in, you know, PME environments. And, you know, a lot of these tools are already well known to many practitioners, but I think we can do better at using them. And in fact, we can probably teach them quite well. So there was a great study at the U.S. Army War College in 2021 where they looked at problem-based learning, which is an idea particularly from the medical fields, and showed that it actually was very effective. I spent some time earlier this year at Harvard Business School and went and learned about their case method of teaching. And, you know, businesses, schools have been using the case method for over 100 years. Yeah. Legal and medical schools use it. I think there's real value in applying it to strategic studies because, you know, strategy is often about large organizations and people within that, but it's also about teaching people to just become comfortable with how do you analyze this situation? How do you work meaningfully through complex and confusing, you know, vast amounts of data and just getting practice at doing that again and again. And you know, I'm certainly not the first to recognize the value of the case method for strategy. You know, there's been some interesting work over the years from various people, but I've started teaching my strategic studies course here at ANU using the case method. And, you know, each week the students just get a different case to work through, 20, 30 pages of material, not all of which is relevant and deliberately kind of helping their decisions. You know, it's meant to kind of be like a real world situation.
Yeah.
And then trying to discuss it and trying to persuade their peers to their view and trying to work through it methodically and building those skills of thinking about it. And, you know, these are proven pedagogies that we can do. And from all the research that I've seen about teaching over the years, as fun as it is to give a lecture, and as much as students often say they like, you know, that great dynamic lecturer who can tell these great stories and knit together all of this information, that active learning where the student has to really struggle, how do I apply this theory? How do I actually make my way through all of this complex data and get some meaningful insight from it? That's where the real learning comes from. It's much more effective at kind of long-term insights into a field. And so I'm trying to really push our focus as a profession onto, you know, ways that we, you know, that the science shows are better form, better pedagogies, better ways of understanding this, because given the kind of problems we have now, like, we can't keep acting in the same way that we have for the last several decades. Like, we need better approaches because we need better strategists over the next 10, 20 years.
Quick question on the case method. For the audience, what's the difference between case studies and case methods? And also, if you're doing this or somebody's looking to try and do this, what is, so to with this model, would it be beneficial to dig up, you know, the battle of something from like 1805, or would it be, if you're trying to teach problem solving strategies of problem solving for people today, would it be more important to use something contemporary?
We're all familiar with case studies, particularly academic case studies, where someone takes a historical event and they say, oh, look, this is a great example of this theory. You know, yeah, the Cold War was this example of the security dilemma and, you know, the action reaction from it. And in those cases, those examples, the researcher, the scholar, the historian has done the thinking for you. Here's mm-hmm. the history and here's the kind of lessons from it. Here's the big insights from it. In the case method, students are given 10 to 20 pages about a historical event or a contemporary event, and the thinking hasn't been done for them. It's just the chronological record. It's the confusing claims from different sides. Hopefully it draws out these kind of central debates.
Yeah.
And it's left to the student to say, well, what should we be doing in this situation? What's the right answer? A lot of cases are designed with a central protagonist, a central person who has to make a decision, or they have to kind of decide between competing campaigns or to diagnose what's going on. And then the student kind of hopefully works through it and says, well, you know, what is needed to be done? What kind of criteria would I look for to help make that decision? What evidence do I then find when I work through the case? And then how do I start to persuade others that this is actually the right judgment? And I've been using cases, some of which are historical and some of which are contemporary. So one I did recently was the Dardanelles campaign in the First World War. Yeah. And it was particularly because it was so different to what the students kind of knew. And so we could draw in ideas about, you know, civ-mil relations in the British system in, you know, the turn of the 20th century, where the military did dominate a lot of these decisions. So all of my civilians in my class kind of had to realize, like, they were in some ways not the decision maker who had this absolute control, but were part of this larger system, and kind of recognizing those roles, you know, but also roles of questions of race and globalization and colonialism and things like that that feed into those questions.
Yeah.
But I also look at more recent ones. So, you know, coming up, we have a case on the leasing of the port of Darwin to a Chinese firm, Landbridge, and saying, well, you know, is that actually a good strategic decision for Australia? And if it's not, you know, what are the actual security problems? And getting students to really care about the details of every specific case, because
yeah,
if they go into government and have to kind of deal with this, then the details matter profoundly. But there are broader principles that come from how we engage that case and how we engage and think about these issues. And you know, one of my great critiques of a lot of strategies, it starts with our principles. It says, you know, we should favor freedom and markets and liberty and democracy. But then when you get to complex, you know, particular events and situations, people say, oh, no, actually, you know, let's support the authoritarian power because they're helpful in this case. Or, you know, let's, you know, limit our companies because it's advantageous to national security. And, you know, your values come through your choices in particular circumstances. And so I think it's useful in the case method that students are forced to confront, well, how do you put your principles into practice, or how do you make actually compromises because the circumstances and the details shape it? So I still do some lectures that I pre-record and give to them to get that theory. I still give them readings from academics or historians, but I think it's a useful way of just, you know, practicing your problem-solving skills as you would once you actually go into a professional career.
When you think about thinking strategically, it's not the topical, emotional almost response answer to problem solving. It's getting through that level of thinking and that level of response and busting down that barrier or getting around that barrier or whatever the term is, but getting past that barrier and getting to the, all right, what's the next level? What's the level beyond that level of thinking about the problems, you know? And I think when you were discussing that idea of leasing the port, or leasing the port at Darwin?
Port of Darwin, yeah.
Yeah, to the Chinese, like that, like, oh yeah, we'll make some money, you know? Well, okay, beyond that, what, you know, what's next, you know? And I think that to me, that was a really insightful example of a good problem solving exercise to work through that. So two questions left, short questions, and then we'll be done here. So I guess last three questions, all short. What's wrong with the ends ways means model? I love it. I say that tongue in cheek. What's wrong with it?
Well, I think Jeffrey Miser has kind of very nicely kind of illustrated many of the problems. So, you know, your readers should, or listeners should go and hear that episode.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it really reflects that idea that the world is orderly and we kind of already know what the ends are. And so it's just about how do we apply resources to get there? And, you know, can we do the same kind of application in each time and taking these things as fixed? You know, what's the diplomatic environment? What's the political environment? What's the military environment? What's the economic one? You know, working through those kinds of structures. And, you know, at times in the 1990s, that probably was actually the best way to do strategy because things were orderly. You had a lot of resources in the US and the West. Yeah. And a kind of regular approach was actually very effective. And, you know, frankly, I think it was a good model for its time. Like, I don't criticize it as a, you know, it would never work or it's not right. Like, I do think it actually made sense in that early 1990s orderly environment. But the world today, you know, from a lot of big studies, a lot of kind of scientists and scholars kind of say, look, it's genuinely much more like what we understand a complex system to be in terms of the dynamics. There are so many more actors who are important in the world today. They have more power. They have more interactions between them, more feedback between the actions of one changing and adapting the behavior and choices of others. And then the way the system develops kind of emerges out of those interactions that are genuinely more complex. And so that means I think our type of strategy, the way we approach it, should evolve with it. So, you know, my critique is not that it never made sense. I do think ends ways means has its use and was probably very effective in the 90s. It's just not so today.
How do we change it? Like, how do you bust down something that's been institutionalized to the point that, like, if you go up to the random person that uses that as, like, currency, and you say, hey, this thing that you've been indoctrinated to believe in, it's not useful anymore. How do you change all these people's minds? This is a general question because I'm with you. I agree. Let's change it. And so I'm using this as a platform to help change it. But how do we change it? Let's get me, you, and Jeff. How do we figure this out?
Look, it's a great question. I mean, you can't change people's minds just by saying you're wrong. People, you know, hold back and say no. It's been useful, or they hold to it. in an earlier part of my scholarly career, I was really interested in the idea of norms, which is the flow of ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do we see groups that take on ideas from other societies and other times or leaders and kind of accept them? And what the research showed is that, you know, you need to connect the new idea to existing ideas of a group if you are to get them to listen to it, and also to allow them to adapt the new idea in ways that kind of suit their existing notions of the world and things like that. And so when I look at ends, ways, means, I mean, one, I don't have that, it never worked. I actually think it did work in certain environments.
Yeah.
And I do think it still has some value today, but it's the second part of the strategic equation, right? It's not the only part.
Yeah.
And the first part is, you know, diagnosing what exactly is the dynamics and the environment we're in and what makes sense as shorter term iterative ends and kind of breaking down that ends question. And then you can start to say, well, how do we get the ways and means? How do we work through it? How do we draw out those, you know, causal links, those theories of victories? That's really important work, but it comes after that first part of diagnosing it. And, you know, that should be done in relation to specific problems. And I think the military get this much more than the civilians, that it should be about the specific problems that we're facing rather than being, you know, let's do this one big cycle for, you know, great power competition and write some big document. And that's the goal here.
Yeah.
No, I think, you know, just making small bits of progress, but meaningfully on direct problems that we're facing is actually the way that we make kind of effective contributions as strategists. So.
All right. That's fair. Anything else on the paper that we didn't hit that you wanted to hit?
Look, part of what really inspired this paper was I went back and read a lot of Cold War strategists. And I've mentioned Keenan a bit, but a real inspiration for me was Andrew Marshall. Andy Marshall led the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon from 1973 to, I think, 2015.
Yep.
And, you know, the Net Assessment Office at the Pentagon, you know, still doing some great work. They're still trying to kind of carry on that way of approaching it. And when I read Marshall's work at first, I didn't understand how he was thinking about issues. And I didn't kind of understand why everybody thought he was this amazing strategic thinker. And in a lot of ways, this paper is my attempt to understand, you know, how he actually was trying to approach the world. And he didn't use this language specifically of strategy as problem solving. But for anyone who does like his work, this is kind of my, as an Australian outsider's attempt to say, well, this is what I think he was trying to do. And, you know, that focus on how do we give decision makers over at least the medium to longer term better ways of understanding their problem, and, you know, better ways of thinking about decisions as part of longer term issues, and really, you know, ask good questions. If you've read it, there's a Reflections on Net Assessment book that has some interviews with Marshall in the 1990s that has recently been published. And there's this nice point where Marshall's kind of ripping one of his analysts and he's like, stop giving me solutions. You know, why don't you tell me what the problem is, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's right. Like a good question is actually far more, with a weak answer, is actually far more valuable than these, you know, amazing, you know, rigorous answers to quite poor questions. And academia these days is very focused on, can we do these amazing methodological answers? And the question comes second. You know, it's often about what we can answer. I'm much more interested, and I get this from Marshall, you know, what are the good questions? And let's really work on getting the right questions first, even if we think our answers aren't very good. And, you know, Marshall's work on kind of the stoking a technological arms race, which then led to the idea of the Star Wars program and things like that, but also particularly around the revolution in military affairs, you know, that was because he had questions about, well, what are the Russians actually doing? What are they thinking here? And, you know, what are they, if they're right, but what if they're wrong? And that's kind of what led to the US kind of really understanding the RMA and all of the fascinating and important stuff that came out of that. So good questions and realizing the value of some of these earlier thinkers, I think, can be very valuable for helping us to find our feet here in this new world.
Well, with that, hopefully we asked some good questions today in the spirit of Andy Marshall and the RMA. So Andrew, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We appreciate you sharing your time with us. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you would share this on social media. We would also appreciate it if you would provide us a rating on Apple Podcast and Spotify. These ratings help new listeners find the podcast. Thank you.